This is the First Time Podcast.
It's us talking writing and publishing.
Welcome to our Masters series,
where we interview Australian and international authors at the top of their games.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to the First Time Podcast.
Masters series. Hello, Catherine Collette.
Hi. I can't even say long time no see because I have seen you in person very recently.
We got to see each other. How much fun was it? I spent so much time saying we had an actual meeting. I felt very professional that we had a planning meeting for season six.
I felt massively professional. And it was like we had the whiteboard. Mm-hmm. We, you know, were brainstorming and taking photos of things. It was really fun. And I got to see your space, your amazing writing space.
Which obviously I cleaned for you because I don't know if you can see behind me now, but it's now covered in books and paper again. We're not going to tell everyone about what we've planned for season six because it's too exciting and it's really cool, but we're just not going to tell them yet.
And we have to hope we pull it off, right? Like...
We've pulled off five seasons so far. The only thing we didn't pull off was the tea and the tea towels. So, you know.
I know.
Like, we've mostly pulled it off and we haven't joined TikTok yet, but maybe that's a thing that we'll do next year. We have to do a shout out. We have to do a shout out to the extraordinary Pip Williams, writer of The Dictionary of Lost Things and new book that's coming out next year, who's become a patron for us, which is just so lovely. Thank you, Pip.
Incredibly lovely.
Anyone can become a patron. Have you listened? Do you think that we should do a bit more of that kind of American style, like really going hard? Sometimes you have to listen to the Patreon pitch for like 4 minutes.
Well, you said that for one of them, at least the benefit of being a Patreon is you get episodes without the pitch.
Without the pitch, right? Don't worry, people. We're not going to do that to you. Tell me what's happening.
We just also want to say thank you to people who have responded to the call out for knowing who has debuts next year. Please keep them and the pictures coming.
There doesn't appear to be a list.
No, there's not a list. We do see all the emails and pictures that come in. We're not always the best at responding. And I always want to say that's not an arrogance. It's just a function of time.
Yes.
We're very grateful.
We are very grateful and we see them and they go in a list. Tell us the ongoing narrative thread of has Catherine heard back on her middle grade novel?
No. Which I'm not. That's just the way of the writing life, isn't it? Writing and waiting. I think I've always had the next idea for the book, for the idea for the next book as I've been writing the one that I'm writing. And I don't have the idea yet. I have ideas, but I have nothing that I'm hooked into. It's a bit unmooring.
That is really unmooring. What are you doing in your writing time in the mornings?
I'm doing The Artist's Way. At least I'm doing morning pages. I'm working a lot more just in paid work, normal work. I've read a lot.
Maybe this is your going fellow time, the Vicky Hastridge's idea of going fellow. Maybe something's growing in there. Something definitely is growing in there. Just have to wait.
Yeah, maybe. Or nothing. Maybe the well is run dry.
The well has not run dry. Do not even say those words. I have not been writing because I've been being a little festival fairy. You know how I like to do festival fairying. Melbourne Rise Festival was last weekend. It was big. It was eventful. There was lots going on.
What is something that you're thinking about since then and what was your favourite moment?
Oh, what is something that I'm thinking about since then? I went to climate change things. I went to hear Joelle Gergis, who's the author of Humanity's Moment. She was actually, you will love this, Catherine. She is one of the Australia's scientists who worked on the last IPCC report. They're all volunteers. They are volunteers, the scientists who do this. So this book, Humanity's Moment, A Climate Scientist's Case for Hope, is her saying this is what we all know and what we're dealing with. We have an emergency right now and I need to communicate it. My work should be to communicate this better to a wider public. So she was incredible. She was on with Jeff Sparrow and Tish King, a woman from the Torres Strait, and it was so good. It was so good. And their basic message at the end of it was, which was actually a message from everything I saw at the festival, was this is a moment to move away from individualism and to a collective action. And the best thing that you can do is to organize or join a group or become part of the kind of collective action, because that's the only way we're going to go get through. So I got Jeff Sparrow's book as well. But that is a brilliant one. And I'm only a couple of chapters in, but I haven't been filled with that leaden kind of feeling I've been filled with before when reading climate stuff. You know, we've talked about that a bit.
Yeah.
It's true and raw and terrifying, but there's also this case for hope, I suppose, that she puts forward. So that was super cool.
And what kind of groups, like what does collective action look like?
You know, Jeff Sparrow, I kind of tweeted some of these things out. Jeff Sparrow said joining existing local groups. Tish King talked about funding for climate advocacy groups, especially grassroots groups. So she's involved in something called Our Island, Our Home, which is a grassroots group from the Torres Strait, I think. Sparrow talked about the fact that trade unions are doing a lot of the work. They talked about Extinction Rebellion, like just not having to reinvent the wheel, the idea that there are people out there who are working super hard and you can either join them with whatever expertise you have or give them money, you know. Something like Seed Mob was another one that Tish King talked about in terms of First Nations kind of advocacy groups as well doing really important work. So, yeah, it felt like something
I love that.
Real to kind of hang your hat on. And then I also, in that vein too, I got to speak to Michelle de Kretzer, which was really lovely because in the interview that I did for the master series, we kind of didn't talk about scary monsters, which we never do when we're talking in those bigger interviews because we're not kind of talking about the last book. We're talking about the whole career. But I asked her kind of what she wanted to see if she flipped that dystopian world she's written in Scary Monsters and flipped it to the kind of world she wanted to see, what it would encompass. And she said, I want a world of private restraint and public luxury. And I was like, that is such a good platform for you to, you know, kind of go forward to the Senate. Basically, the audience were like, yeah, we've got you. But the idea that, you know, the health system, the education system, our national parks, all of those things are funded brilliantly and that we move back from that kind of individualism. So it was, yeah, it was a super, super duper that. Weekend. And I also walked away with, this is a text one,
a new book.
How funny that I did. Alice Boyle's new book, Dancing Barefoot, which won the text prize. I don't know if it was last year. I didn't get to see her, but this has got a lot of buzz about it and seems really cool. So I'm looking forward to reading that. And this one, which is an anthology edited by Michaela Saunders, who just won the David Unipon Award. It's called This All Come Back Now. It's an anthology of First Nations speculative fiction. And she was in convo with Evelyn Araluen, and it was like a masterclass. I was trying to tweet to catch up just with the kinds of resources that they were sharing, but it was honestly like a university class, a whole course in an hour. It was so good. Anyway, so I'm looking forward to reading that too.
Are any of those Melbourne Writers Festival's chats available online? Is that something that they do, or are they just...
That's a very good question. I think that they do release them afterwards, some of them as podcasts, and some of them were online events which might be able to be caught up with. I saw Eve Rees last night, who spoke at Jacinta Parsons' launch for her new book, A Question of Age. Such a cool launch. Very cool. But I know that Eve was doing blogging. So I think that if you go to the Melbourne Writers Festival website, you'll be able to find some kind of summaries. And they were also saying that whoever was doing the Melbourne Writers Festival Twitter was getting, and I think Sonia Nair was doing that as well, was absolutely nailing getting some quotes down. So if people want to do their own going back to follow, you can do that. But yes, also JP's launch. What fun. It makes me it's the argument, I think, like for Mandy Beaumont's launch earlier this year of The Furies, the argument to have a kind of creative concept as your book launch was just so fun. Like, we, Jacinta did not talk about her book. She had six other people sing and talk and, you know, pay homage to the idea of aging and did not talk about her book. And it was just kind of so brilliantly fun. What have you been reading?
Okay. I have been sitting on this for such a long time. Crawdad's not my favourite book. Delia was in the news a couple of months ago because she was allegedly involved in a murder.
Mm-hmm.
So had you heard this?
I had heard it.
This is crazy. So her and her husband go to Zambia. She's a biologist, probably specialising in marshes. Just going to say that. They went over there to help with elephants and other animals, got very involved in anti-lobbying against poaching. Husband went a bit mad with it, like hanging out of planes and throwing firecrackers at poachers and things. Anyway, they also did something, and I don't know if this was Delia or this was just the husband. What was it called? Village something, where they would go to find poachers in the middle of the night and wake them up in their beds. Very strange. Anyway, a poacher was killed, and I think the fingers allegedly have been pointed at Delia's husband that she had some involvement.
Do you
scandalous
think
of the first order?
Let's talk about the idea that what is the phrase?
All publicity
is good publicity. Like, do you think that that sold more books? Do you think anyone returned their book when they learned that she was involved in a murder thing? Like, maybe we need to think about this, Catherine, for our next year's marketing.
I think you got to get on Reese's book club. Crawdads is part of Reese's book club. I think if Reese Witherspoon picks you out, that's the ticket. I don't know. I just find it so bizarre, like such a weird backstory. Maybe. It's probably not bad publicity. It's definitely falling more on the husband than it is on Delia.
I don't reckon it's bad publicity at all. We watch this space, see if she goes down for it. Let me move quickly to books that I'm reading, because I also want to introduce our featured segment. This book arrived. I've been so looking forward to it. It's called The Raven's Song. It is middle grade, spec fic, and it's a collaboration between Zana Freilon, the excellent and amazing Zana Freilon, author of The Bone Sparrow, The Lost Soul Atlas, and a bazillion other things, and Bren McDibble. And they wrote this book. They met on Twitter and they wrote this book in a Google document without having ever met. They did it, you know, chapter each. I won't say who wrote what chapter. I'm only a couple of chapters in. It is so good. The world building is effortless. Brilliant. So Raven's Song, middle grade, up your alley, Catherine Collette. I also wanted to mention this one, which I have, Exiles, the new one from Jane Harper. It is the farewell to Folk. Folk. How do you say his name? Folk.
Oh, Aaron she's Folk. Killing him off.
Well, I'm not going to say what happens to him. But yeah, it's the last one with him. I get to talk to Jane next week. Unfortunately, no one can come if you haven't already got a ticket, because it's a sellout. But that was super exciting and, as you can imagine, read in one hit, as was Cut by Susan White, which is our featured
book. You've been talking
about
this book a lot. I've heard you talk about this book several times.
Yeah, it's super good. And I talked to Susan about it. Today, our featured book segment is brought to you by Affirm Press, and I'm delighted to be talking to Susan White about her new novel, Cut. Susan White is a doctor and a writer. As a clinical geneticist, Susan hunts for answers to undiagnosed genetic conditions in children. Her first novel for younger readers was Take the Shot, published in 2019. Her new novel, and first for an adult audience, is Cut, which was shortlisted for the Kill Your Darlings Unpublished Manuscript Award in 2017. Her writing has been published in The Big Issue, The School Magazine, Melbourne's Child Magazine, and The Reader's Anthology from the Emerging Writers Festival. Welcome to the First Time Podcast, Sue.
Thank you for having me, Kate.
Okay, to begin, can you please give us the pitch for your new novel, Cut?
Sure. Cut is the story of Carla, who's a young doctor trying to make it as the first female surgeon in a traditional, prestigious Melbourne hospital. She thinks she can handle the sexism that is her every day, but an assault at a boozy workplace dinner leaves her traumatised, and she struggles to cope with the misogyny and to compete for the job she so desperately wants. Really, Cut is about what happens when the ambition of a young, independent woman collides with a world made for men by men.
I could not put this novel down once I started reading it. So I think I put a message to you on Instagram at 1 o'clock or something in the morning when I finished reading it. It's fast paced. It's gripping. It could easily be shelved kind of alongside thrillers in a way, or alongside contemporary explorations of sexism and misogyny in other settings. I know it's been compared to Diana Reid's Love and Virtue, Yumiki Kodota's Emotional Female, and like Dr. Kodota, and also recently published Nila Janakiramanan, the author of The Registrar. You are a medical professional, Sue. Can you tell us about your work and how your experiences influenced the writing of Cut?
Yeah, so I work as a genetics doctor, which means I see children with undiagnosed genetic conditions. And I guess, so I've been in the medical system for more than 20 years in terms of training and then working as a specialist. And over that time, I guess I've observed, experienced, absorbed a lot of the cultural environment in which I work. And I think, to be absolutely honest, I didn't really register the impact of that on me, including probably some, you know, not very pleasant incidents of misogyny when I was a trainee especially. But when Me Too happened, I think that got me, it just made me sort of look around me with different eyes, and I started talking to people about things I'd experienced and talking to other women in medicine about what they'd experienced, and was sort of astonished to witness that this bunch of talented, independent, brilliant women of varying ages were pretty universally had experiences of misogyny that pretty universally they'd done nothing about. And even when I reflected on my own experiences, what struck me was that I hadn't really judged the men involved. I judged myself for not being tougher or coping with a more perhaps masculine approach, not being more combative, showing emotion, being weak. I judged myself rather than them, and it really fueled for me this desire to explore my own internalized misogyny and the misogyny in the system in which I work, which, while it is improving, the culture is still steeped in that male gaze, I suppose.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the character of Carla and what's at stake for her?
Sure. Yeah, Carla was really the anchor for me about as I found my way into this novel. She was the character I could see very vividly from early on. So she is a surgical trainee. She's finished all the components of her surgical training, and she is wanting to get her first consultant post, which I guess for doctors who have trained as a specialist, that usually means they've been training since medical school for 10 to 12 years. And in surgery, that's pretty hardcore in terms of the commitment on the part of the trainee themselves. So she's desperate for this job, and she really does want to belong in this hospital that has that is very prestigious. So there's a lot of reputation that comes with getting a consultant post at a place like this. But I guess in the environment she's working in, she has to make more and more sacrifices of herself in order to try and get this consultant post. And I really wanted that exploration. I wanted her to want the traditional environment because I think perhaps that rings true to me, that the majority of doctors, especially I think for women, one of the reasons they keep quiet, even in a system that might ostensibly encourage you to speak out about things that are upsetting or incidents of harassment, if you want to belong, it's very hard. If you go back to the sort of school playground, if you want to belong, it's very hard to speak up to the school bully and stand your ground and imagine that you're going to be included afterwards. And so I really wanted to play with that idea.
I'm really conscious when I speak to you and to other writers whose experience in a particular field really informs their work, that sometimes what we do is we forget to talk about the incredible craft of the writing. And so I want to talk about that too. One of the structural elements that I really loved in Cut was in the opening of each chapter, you have these wonderful kind of definitions of different medical terms, resuscitate, satellite lesion, proliferative phase. I loved these, the specificity of them, which is putting your particular specialist knowledge to use, and also the layers of meaning that they added to each chapter. At what point in the writing process did you bring these in? And I suppose more generally, the structure is quite complex of this book. How long did it take you to get that right?
Oh, okay, the structure. Just did my head in. Seriously, it really was a huge learning curve for me as a writer. And I think for me, I wrote it, I had many drafts of this book that were linear and chronological, and I had big problems with maintaining tension in the book. Obviously, the assault is a big incident, and where I placed that was kind of problematic for me. And I think I had some sort of epiphany moment where I realized that a non-linear structure or a structure that jumped from the incident and then back in time, that posed questions for the reader that helped drive the momentum. And I had some sort of moment while I was writing that where I just felt the energy in the words, and I thought, oh, I think this is what I'm meant to be feeling. I'm going to keep going with this. And that was some kind of eureka moment for me. It still took me a couple more drafts to get that kind of tight and get the positioning of the assault in exactly the right spot. But that was where I worked with Kelly Doust at Affirm to kind of restructure the shape of it a little bit to really, really maximise, I guess, the tension and the payoff. Coming to the definitions, I think I have that really weird thing in my brain of I sort of really do conceptualise it as left and right brain, and my left kind of medical, ordered, critical, generally a bit negative brain, right, freewheeling, a bit wacky. And I think I have to try quite hard or give my creative or playful side, I have to really silence that that left side, that orderly side of my thinking. So that definition thing came reasonably late, but I really liked the, it was sort of a playful thing to me. I love words that can do more than one thing. And I also love the medical language has amazing sort of phonetics to it, you know, just the sound of some of the words. And I loved being able to use them in such a way that they were concrete and literal, but had some kind of hint, thematic hint or connection with the chapter. So that was just really me letting myself have fun with the language.
The novel was shortlisted for the KYD Unpublished Manuscript Award back in 2017. You then went on to publish your novel, Take the Shot, for younger readers. Was that the kind of big break that you needed? Like, what had your writing practice looked like up until that point, and how did you go about getting those publishing deals?
Yeah, it's a funny sequence of events, isn't it, when you look back on it? But I think, so I studied at RMIT sort of over about a decade.
As all the best students do. Let's just make that note.
Huge gratitude to RMIT for everything they taught me. And I had both manuscripts at sort of different stages of development, but also different problems that I was trying to resolve. And I think I'd get as far as I could with one and then go and work on the other for a bit and sort of toggle between the two a little bit, and also had a couple of kids along the way, those kind of things. So the KYD shortlisting was a massive moment of validation for me as a writer. Confidence has always been just a real big challenge for me, and to have KYD pick my book out of a big pile of applicants was enormously validating. The book, for example, then was still quite linear and possibly even in the third person. I can't actually remember when I switched from third to first at some point. And so that was massive. And I think it helped me take more risks with my writing. Somehow I got over myself a little bit and got out of the way. And when the writing needed me to be a bit braver, I was able to be that way. And I think that helped a firm picked up Take the Shot out of the Slush Pile, which was amazing. And I learned so much. I worked with Davina Bell in that editing process, and I learned so much about what story needed and the lazy aspects of some of my writing where I thought, it's good enough, it'll do. And Davina didn't agree that it would do, you know, and that was fabulous, rigorous, kind of, I guess, taking it from a hobby that I loved, that I, you know, workshopped with my friends who told me I was wonderful, and to something that really needed to sing on the page, on every page, not just a couple of good bits here and there. So that was amazing, and helped me establish a relationship with a firm. And so then when I finished Take the Shot, I realized some of the things I needed to do with cut, and went back and rewrote it again, and then submitted it following that. And that was the story.
So it sounds like in the way that you've talked about working with both Kelly and with Davina, I know that you also have done workshops with Sarah Santillis, that you really take on board that kind of feedback that comes back through those working relationships. Who or what else has helped along the way in terms of getting your writing to the level where you've been really happy with it?
Yeah, the Sarah Santelli's workshops are brilliant for me at accessing what I think is of as kind of my subconscious, or bypassing that critical part of my brain that often gets in the way. And my workshop group, who grew out of RMIT classes, have been an enormous source of support, feedback, especially the structural stuff that I've always found a bit challenging, but also just belief and on the long road that is trying to get published, kind of bolstering my confidence. They're probably the big influences, I would say.
I'm always conscious that I spend a lot of time kind of lamenting that I haven't got another professional string to my bow, like yourself or Mel Cheng or Catherine as an engineer. How do you, though, actually juggle and balance your work as a geneticist and a medical professional with getting the writing done?
Yeah, so I write early mornings, before my teenage kids get out of bed, so I get up early-ish and I have to avoid anything online that otherwise kind of the spell is broken, especially my work email. I have to 100% stay off the hospital email. And yeah, I try and write. So I kind of go by a mantra of a little bit, a lot. So pretty much write every day. But sometimes I might write for half an hour. I try and write longhand, especially whenever I'm stuck or whenever I am feeling like I can't access the energy of the story. And I've learned to accept that it's going to take the time it's going to take, which might be years, because the other thing to say is I do work part-time. I work sort of 3.5 days a week in the hospital, but it kind of can encroach on everything fairly readily. So I have to put boundaries in place. And I think that in many ways, the hospital work is a great way of making me feel useful and not get too bound up in my own thoughts of why the hell is this novel not working? Because I can go and do something functional and feel, I don't know, it's a bit like putting a load of washing on and hanging it out. You know, you've done a job and it kind of worked, right? And for the moment, the washing basket is a little emptier. Whereas, yeah, I don't know, the struggle of writing is such a sort of profound, complex, in your head thing. So in fact, I think I'm very lucky that they counterbalance each other. And if I don't write, I am just a miserable sack of potatoes. Like I'm not very nice to be around. The medical work gets on top of me. I see a lot of suffering and sadness in my job. And I'm sure that the medical work is somehow nourished by a process where my soul gets to explore where it's at and find some peace with the things I'm witnessing.
Such a beautiful answer, Sue. Can you please share with us the best writing advice perhaps you've been given or that you'd like to pass on to other writers?
Yeah, so I'm sort of blatantly stealing this advice.
Excellent.
It's kind of a melding of some advice I've heard Charlotte would give, possibly on your esteemed podcast, of which I'm an avid fan, with some George Saunders kind of mantra. And for me, I guess, and maybe this advice is particularly for anybody whose job is very ordered and linear, and or anyone whose critical brain is busy and might get in the way. And it's really about listening to your inner voice and following where the heat of the story is. And I know that Charlotte talks a lot about that, and George Saunders talks about, you know, looking at each sentence and trying to feel, does it sort of sway the lever to the positive side or the negative side? And for me, I try and think about that in a very visceral way. Do I feel the energy at each sort of juncture point, or do I not? And really, if I don't, have to be brutal then about what I do in that moment, which might be cut the scene or cut the character or even the idea, you know, might be quite profound. But that advice has helped me access, I think, the heart of what I'm actually trying to write. So for me, that's the most fundamental thing I have to hold on to when I'm writing.
Sue, can you recommend a debut book for us, any time, any genre?
I can. And my recommendation is a tiny bit cheeky because I haven't actually finished this book, but in my defense, it came out the same day as mine, and I've read the first third of it, and I just know I'm going to love it. So it's only been out for a short time, but it's Catherine Hoare's The Stranger, and Catherine is also a RMIT PWE alumnus, and she was in a class with me, and I always admired her really vivid dark, rich prose that had just sort of this black humour in it. And The Stranger is a sort of a feminist Western, I think, is the description. And it's the premise is fabulous. And I know that it's going to be a great book, even though I haven't quite got to the end.
You're absolutely allowed to do that. And I saw that come up on socials yesterday, and that is absolutely on my list as well. Sue, congratulations on Cut. It's just such a fabulous, provocative novel, and I know that lots of people will be talking about it. Where can people catch you in events coming up over the next little while?
Yeah, I'm for Melbourne people, I will be at Robinson's on the 22nd of September. Robinson's the Glen, I should say, talking with Philippe Vukasin, who is the author of the wonderful book Modern Marriage. And Phil is a doctor writer as well, and I'm really, really looking forward to that discussion. So, yeah, please come along. It should be a great night.
Fantastic. Sue White, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me, Kate.
What have you been reading, Catherine?
Okay, here is a book that I cannot believe I didn't know existed. It's called Making Stories, How 10 Australian Novels Were Written. It's edited by Kate Grenville and Sue Wolfe. It's from 1993. You are making a face that's like, exactly how did you not know?
How did you not know? I've talked about this before.
Have you really?
Yes.
I have just completely, completely missed that.
It's, you know, the thing about this book, it's at Varuna. I read it first at Varuna and it's out of print. And I thought about stealing it from Varuna, I must admit, because I was so into it. I didn't. And then for a very brief period at the end of last year, because basically I want to write that book again, right? That was one of the ideas of the PhD.
Oh my God, does this book scream Kate Mildenhall?
Write this again, right?
No.
But Allen and Unwin did print on demand for this tiny little bit. And so I got a print on demand copy, but I looked the other day when you were looking for it and it's not there anymore. Anyway, I cut in with my face. Go.
It's hard to get and I haven't started yet. It's literally just arrived. I think I had to get it from the UK secondhand. But the concept is 10 great Australian writers and they each have a chapter and they attempt to show you with their drafts and their notes and comparing, you know, what ended up being published, how their book was made, how they put it together, how they wrote it. It's so, like, I'm so excited about it.
It's so
good. Do you have
a
favourite chapter?
I often go, I have many favourite chapters in there, but one of the things that I often return to is Peter Carey talks about this process that he has of, he calls it cantilevering, where if he gets stuck, he just goes back to the start of the same paragraph and he writes it again. And then he goes back and he writes it again. And he keeps on getting a little bit kind of further each time until he gets going again. And when I was looking originally at the start of the PhD, I was looking at the idea of momentum and I was really fixated on Carey's idea of cantilevering. But oh my gosh, every chapter is incredible. It's an interview.
I'm so excited.
Plus the draft material, plus the finished material. So it's this real deep dive analysis on the line of how things changed. It's exquisite. And I tell you what, if someone wants to commission us to write the next version of Making Stories, I am here for it. I am so here for it.
It is incredible. Great authors too. Peter Carey, as you say, Helen Garner, Elizabeth Jolly, Patrick White, Thomas Keneally. Very good. It could stand for a lens of greater diversity. But
yeah well, that's why I reckon a new version right now. Give us 20 authors. Oh, sorry.
The other is a book you have also read. You are emotional today.
I am emotional today.
You are alive. Okay, another really good one is Still Life by Sarah Winman. You've interviewed Sarah for the pod. I've seen this book everywhere. It's excellent, excellent. What I love about it is it's deep and it's complex, but it is in no way depressing. It is happy and uplifting and hopeful and affectionate. the premise is basically sort of a group of people who are friends and know each other. They're all originally English-based. One is an English soldier who's quite young. During the Second World War, he saves a man in Italy from committing suicide, prevents him from killing himself. And a few years later, that man dies and has left this soldier this property. It is. So he goes to live there and other people come and visit and different bits and pieces. It's just such a book that is necessary and a type of book that is necessary, and I cannot recommend it enough.
Yeah, she's extraordinary. And for people who are at the Writer's Center, because of my scheduling, I did not. It was the great kind of tragedy of my weekend that I didn't get in to see Sarah Winnett.
She was,
but apparently,
yeah,
she was here. Her sessions, both with Christos and with Elsa Piper, were sellouts and just exquisite. And she showed all of the reasons why she is such an exquisite writer. But also for people, if you haven't yet read Still Life or any, have gone back and read any of her books, she reads the audiobooks of all of her works, and she's an actor by trade, and they are also exquisite. In fact, so exquisite that it's now, do you have a book that you sometimes put on just to, and then put the sleep function on your audio listening app?
Oh, I do that with podcasts now.
Yeah.
I started that in COVID, the comfort of hearing people talk at you.
Yeah,
and
well,
been able to stop.
Sarah Winman is the voice to take you to sleep. Not that sounds wrong. I mean, it's so soothing and beautiful, and I listen back to the same chapters over and over because it's just so exquisite.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, yeah. So go and listen to those. A Year of Marvelous Ways would be my recommendation first to go and listen to.
What have you been listening to aside from A Year of Marvelous Ways?
Yeah, well, a couple of things, actually. One really interesting one, not in any way uplifting or light. It's called Breaking Down Collapse. It's two American guys, Corey and Kaylin. I don't actually know what their last names are, but it's looking at the idea of ecological civilization kind of collapse. And they break it down over about 12 episodes. I think I haven't finished it yet. But the premise is that one of them knows a lot about this area and the other one doesn't know anything. So it's kind of an explainer. And I love the way that is set up. It's really interesting to listen to as someone coming in and kind of wanting to get, a whole kind of background understanding of, like, okay, what does fiscal collapse look like? Okay, what does, ecological collapse look like? So that one is really clever and interesting, but needs to be broken up because also at some points it makes you want to kind of drive off the road and think, why are we even here and what are we doing?
Do you think personalities have a tendency to look in at that or look away from that stuff? Do you, is there a level of enjoyment in that? I can't think of anything worse.
I think there's a level of kind of interest and hook at the moment for me because I'm writing into it in the novel at the moment.
Yeah.
So there's something about wanting to understand systems of collapse that's really important to me. But yeah, yes, I did realize that combined with my Avatar visit, listening to Breaking Down Collapse did end up putting me in bed for a couple of days where I couldn't kind of move. So one has to be a little careful. And actually, they do a warning about that in each episode, and they do say this might not be the kind of podcast for you. So do bear that in mind.
I did hear someone say, and it was a completely unscientific thing, but on a podcast, they were saying that in terms of comfort reads, there are two types of people. One that would gravitate towards crime because hearing about dark things makes them think they can protect themselves.
Nice.
Like that it helps them to understand what they need to do, and others that would gravitate or prefer to gravitate to romance because
yeah.
It just is... yeah, I don't,
that's
I don't
interesting.
Know.
I think it's mood based as
it
well,
resonated.
Or seasonal.
Yeah, that's true. That's
yeah.
true.
Yeah. In a similar way, for kind of learningness, I haven't ever listened to the ABC podcast, The Philosopher's Zone, before. Mm-hmm. Have you listened to that?
Only when it used to play whatever day it was coming home from work. Or
yeah,
going to work.
Yeah.
Or- back in the day of pre-podcasts.
Pre-podcasts, exactly. This is one I've been driving home on my own late a couple of nights recently, and this is a really good one to go, okay, what do I need to kind of understand for what I want to write about tomorrow? Oh, yeah, I'll search it up and kind of get a quick explainer on that particular thing. So I really liked that. And I also was talking about First Draft, a dialogue on writing, the Mitzi Rapkin podcast recently. And I said to someone, I talk about it all the time on the podcast. And they were like, no, you never have. So this is me saying.
You mentioned it, but not, yeah. not multiple, definitely not multiple times.
It's also a really good one. I hadn't listened for a while. I was chasing up interviews with the US writer Lydia Yuknovich, whose book Thrust I really want to read, and I'm waiting for it to be printed here because it's not printed yet in Australia. And her interview was terrific, kind of blew my mind. And the interviewer, Mitzi Rapkin, just does a brilliant job. So super good. And there's some Aussies on there, like Charlotte Woods on there, a few other people have been added to it recently. So I really, you know, liked that too. Go on. What else?
My only listen really at the moment is the How to Fail podcast, which I just offers gem after gem after gem. One of the more recent episodes is with Vanessa Feltz, who I hadn't heard of, probably well known in the UK. I think she had her own talk show called Vanessa, maybe in the 90s or around that Oprah era, where, era when talk shows were really big. Just lovely person to listen to. You can totally see why she would have been good on a talk show. But the vulnerability in that podcast is so just mesmerizing. It's just a great podcast, and I really love that episode. So highly recommend.
Anything, what is on your screen at the moment in terms of viewing habits? Because you sometimes have some excellent ones that I have never watched.
Oh, they're all Real Housewives. There's nothing. Cass Moriarty recommended to me that I watch Selling the OC, which is part of the Selling Sunset series. It's based around real estate in America. It's, yeah, the usual kind of lowbrow, beautifully dressed women, beautiful houses, people arguing. But what's interesting about it is they kind of, normally you know the villains from the outset, but this is like a subversion in that who you're kind of, the viewer is intended to be on the side of by the end. You're like, oh, you're the baddie, not the goodie.
That's very
that's
good.
My only watching recommendation.
Well, the, I'm reading this at the moment, Everything Bad is Good for You by Stephen Johnson, subtitled How Today's Popular Culture is Actually Making Us Smarter. And there's a whole essay in there about how reality television and the types of television that we are consuming is so clever and so good for us. I think it's completely up your alley, and I will share it with you once.
Oh my God, that's so validating.
Exactly, exactly. So don't let anyone, especially me, shame you about your reality television habits. I am still watching. I am nearly at the end. I have two episodes to go of season four of Stranger Things. Oh my goodness. I love it so much, and I want to just put it out there. You know how sometimes I like putting out what I want to happen, a little bit of manifesting kind of your secret vibes. I want to interview the Duffer brothers. And, you know, obviously they're so famous and impressive that there is not even any way to contact them. Like, I have started Googling this, and everyone in the world has obviously Googled it because they want to pitch their brilliant concept to the Duffer brothers. I don't want to pitch anything. I just want to talk to them. So if anyone can work out how I can talk to the Duffer brothers, let me know. Or I also really do want to talk to some screenwriters for next year. Do you want to, you want to talk television next year too, don't you? So pitch us your screenwriters that we should talk to, maybe, if people should do that. Maybe they'll just call. Hey,
we heard maybe they'll call. They're probably listeners. They're
they are probably listeners. Do you have anything coming up that you want to share with our good listeners, Catherine Collette?
I do, in a way. It's Toastmasters related, and it's quite far off. But I have two things. One is going on the Toastmasters podcast. This is their official international podcast, which will be very cute. I was interviewed by the two hosts, and they asked a good question. You know when there's a question that you haven't realised that you've wanted to be asked? But it was about whether I worried about offending Toastmasters in the satirical elements of the book. Anyway, so we had a good discussion about that, and they were good people to talk to because when they had started the podcast about Toastmasters, it was actually a different combination of two people. One of the guys is still doing it, but his former co-host they used to have this segment before they were affiliated with Toastmasters officially, where the former co-host would call up and pretend to be a Toastmaster that was concerned about some minor rule that they'd gotten wrong in the. So it was very consistent with some of the satire in the competition. So it was a really nice discussion. But I also did an article. They interviewed me. Toastmasters has a magazine that goes to its 400,000 members around the world. And I was like, oh, my God, I'm going to go in the magazine. But they've just, like, literally just made the magazine online, which is a bit sad. Anyway, so I got some really interesting people emailing as a consequence of this article. One was a woman who's a volunteer at a men's felon prison, a prison for male felons in Illinois. And they have a Toastmasters club there and they're running a competition. And she said, I want to read them your book. And I was like, I can send you copies. I'll send them out. But there's rules around sending books to people in prison. So I sent her the PDF. And she's going to read it.
I love that. I love that. That's so cool. Cute. I want you to be able to visit. I want you to be able to visit and do a visit with the toaster. Yeah, maybe sort of. That's all very cool. Did you not also do an conversation, the burger conversation with Ben Hobson?
Oh, yeah. That will come out next month, I think. So not long after this episode is released. And we spoke about Maeve Binchy. And I got Ben Hobson to read. I couldn't decide which Maeve Binchy book. So I went with The First Time Concept and got him to read her first book, which I have read on ebook. So I didn't really know how long it is. It's epic. It's like Lord of the Rings, Bible's length book.
I am so ready for that conversation.
Claimed to enjoy it. Yeah. So tell us, what have you got coming up? Exciting events.
I have got on the 7th of October, I'm doing an online session for Writing New South Wales. I think it's called First Friday. It's free online. You can, I'm being interviewed and you can ask questions about, you know, publishing and writing things. So that's cool. I think it's like a lunchtime. We'll put the links in the show notes. And I'm also going to my first international festival when I go to the Verb Wellington Festival in November. So that's at the end of the residency that I got with the Michael King Writer Centre, which is also with Varuna. And I'm super excited and super intimidated. But the program looks incredible.
I'm on
opening night. I'm one of like six people on opening night talking on the radical possibility of craft. The theme of the festival is radical possibility. So that will be very cool. Tracy Farr is interviewing me about The Mother Fault. So I'll have to remember what my last book was about and be able to talk articulately about it.
Does it feel distant? It must feel distant.
It does feel distant.
12 months? Has it had an anniversary or 2-year anniversary?
2-year anniversary. Yeah, 2-year anniversary. My goodness me. Wow. Get cracking on that next book, Kate. But the coolest thing is that I'm doing the Bad Diaries salon on the Saturday night. Does this not sound like the coolest thing? They do what's called a lit crawl. So there's like a bunch, maybe 20 events on at different venues or within walking distance, like at 6 o'clock, at 7 o'clock, at 8 o'clock. And then you all walk on to the party at the end. It's like my kind of a thing. But I have to work out which of my terrible diaries. I think the deal for Bad Diaries is that you can't edit. So you have to read something from one of your diaries and you can't edit. And I don't know whether to go to the like very earnest, thank God Mum took me to the library today, kind of 10-year-old diaries of Kate, yep, or to the angsty, deep angsty 16-year-olds, or the other one that I've got a lot of like an epic kind of collection is, you know, the backpacker overseas seeing the world, all starry-eyed.
Oh
so
my God.
Any of those
you
could
need to
be
do a trilogy of these
excruciating. So I just have to work out how willing I am to be to kind of embarrass myself, I suppose, in a safe space.
Oh, I'm excited. I want to hear more about these diaries.
I'll do a taster. Or maybe I can get people to vote on what I should do. Yeah, nice. Good. Okay, I'll get them ready for next time. You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to the First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.